Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation with Tom Merritt and Leo Laporte. Episode 24, recorded September 14th, 2011. John Perry Barlow. It's time for Triangulation, the show that I love doing probably perhaps the most, because we get to get somebody who's really smart, a great thinker, bring them in, and Tom Merritt and I will sit down and talk to him and kind of pick his brain. And this is the show where I learn the most. Tom Merritt, good to see
you. Absolutely agree. Good to be here.
And let us welcome Wild Turkey Fueled Mr. John.
not at the moment, right?
Oh, we got to fix that lower third. It's not Don Tapscott on there.
Really so. Smart guy that you were.
You are the really smart guy.
Okay, well.
Actually, you know, most recently
my
saw
brain
you.
Was made for picking.
There you go. At TEDx Marin, where you did just a fire-rousing talk about the internet and how it's changing the world and how we better get off our asses because they're going to take it away from us. I just thought that was great. And I think the people went out of there. You were the last speaker, all charged up.
Yeah, well, you know. Anything you can do to charge up people from Marin is...
Let's go have quiche and some white wine and talk about this.
Right. Usually they get charged up when they run out of brie.
I tell you how much of a big thinker you are. This is your second appearance on Triangulation, this time in person.
I feel more triangulated.
You're right. I'm stuck in the middle. Just back from Burning Man?
I am.
You've gone, and you go every year?
You said well, it was less burning this year, too.
Well, it was Burning Man light. You know, it was very, very pleasant out there on the playa.
So smoldering man.
Now we have 20,000 newbie burners who are going to come back thinking that it's a really cool place to be and nothing horrible ever happens.
The weather was very good.
Weather was excellent. The playa was the best I've seen it in many years. It was, the whole thing was like a, you know, like a runway.
Yeah.
And, you know, hard and no dust. And
what brings you back every year?
Oh, I guess I just don't have enough natural disasters in my life.
They say that's part of it, is how hard it is to live there.
It's the intentional complexity movement.
Right.
You know, I think, you know, people need a sense of urgency.
Yeah, we're complacent.
It's just people need a sense of connection, which doesn't form very well unless you've got shared purpose that has some urgency around it. And, trying to organize the unorganizable under adverse conditions is really a good way to breed a sense of human connection.
That's interesting. I never even really...
I mean, it really... It is intentionally an unnatural disaster.
Right. And that, it's we've all observed that when things go bad, that's when the human...
Yeah, people pull together. And
spirit,
you put yourself in that community necessity situation.
But, I go mostly now because it appeals so strongly to my sense of irony. You've never seen such bureaucracy.
Well, it's a
grown
city,
up like crabgrass in the space of this intentional anarchy.
They have a police force, they have a fire department.
They have bureaucracy that is, you know, exceeds the federal government and includes the federal government. So,
is anyone studying that?
Well,
that's a great microcosm.
I'm studying it in a very anecdotal way, but yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a. What happens is that you get an unwillingness on the top to create process.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have the same kind of architectural systems that we had in the internet, which was a wonderful place.
Because engineers built it.
For bureaucracy to be eliminated by the architecture.
Right.
So there are all these opportunities for former hall monitors to suddenly insert themselves in the middle of a flow and start creating procedure. And there's nothing inherently there to say no. You can't actually do that. I ran into a number of cases this year where somebody was being a little tin dictator, and it wasn't like I could drive down to Center Camp and tell Larry that there was an overly assertive burner in a critical location, because he would say, "Well, yeah. So what did you do about it?"
Right. Right. That's interesting. You almost need an anarchist constitution if you're going to have anarchy.
Yeah.
And you need rules.
That becomes
really
syndicalism.
No kidding.
Isn't that what Noam Chomsky was always on about?
Was he?
Some sort of syndicalism.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Do we see that happening with the internet?
Well,
where the hall monitors have showed up and they're trying to inject
I think it's actually worse. I mean, the traditional bureaucracies have shown up.
Yeah.
And the governments have shown up. And they are...
the chiefs we of have all hall
we
monitors.
Finally reached that point that you know, some of us saw coming 20 years ago, where the powers that have been will suddenly realize that this little anarchist project that the kids kind of put together as a hobby is actually essential to their continued operations, and they want to impose themselves on it. They want to impose all the governmental and economic standards that they've been able to maintain over the last, well, in some cases 2,000 years on this new environment. And you know, I think it's going to be very interesting, but the governance of cyberspace, at least more or less to this point, was a consequence of a government of ideas proposed by engineers who had a very clear understanding of the political consequences of their actions.
That's surprising, actually. Engineers don't,
well,
we don't normally think of them
we
as political.
Were lucky.
Yeah, we were lucky.
I mean, I one time had a conversation with Paul Barron, the late lamented Paul Barron, who
BBN,
in many ways invented the internet by inventing packet switch networking,
right,
while he was at RAND. And I said, were you really thinking about trying to come up with a network that couldn't be decapitated by a nuclear attack?
That's the story. That
right, that's
around.
The story.
You hear that?
And he said, well, no, I was trying to come up with a network that didn't have a head.
There's a difference.
Yeah. And you know, he gave me this sort of sly smile, like, if you're in on the joke, you know what I was thinking. And all of those guys were like that. They really thought about the political consequences of their architectural choices.
Network address translation has a similar story behind it, right?
Yeah, we were exactly. talking to a VisiCalc guy, Bob Frankston.
Yep.
And he talks...
Who has a great idea for... You know, replacing DNS.
Yeah, we've talked. Actually, we've talked about him a little bit about community.
I mean, his
internet,
is,
but
his is a little overly complex, I think.
but isn't the reason that the internet was able to grow up the way it was is because nobody was paying attention. It was a system that people were able to play in without oversight. Once people started paying attention, now we've got this bureaucracy. But my hope is that there's always a place where nobody is paying attention. Maybe it's Tor, or maybe it's Usenet, or maybe
whether they're paying attention or not, it's whether they can.
Mm-hmm.
And also whether the system is open enough to a scaling kind of metamorphosis, which it was and has been, so that decisions that are made that seem to make sense and can scale and self-duplicate throughout the system do so. And I think we're a ways from anybody being in a good position to do something about that.
That's encouraging. You know, Tim Wu talks about this in the Master Switch, that the systems start open like the long-distance systems start open, but as soon as the powers and governments realize there's value here, they shut it down. They basically monopolize it again.
Well, you know...
And I've been thinking the internet may not be like that. I hope
if I thought that there were no danger of that, we would have folded up EFF a long time ago.
Is that really why EFF exists?
EFF is there to keep the internet free.
Right.
And you know, to one day achieve our vision that it will be possible for anybody anywhere to know anything that is reasonably well known by any part of humanity, and to assist the accumulation of that knowledge with his own,
right,
without interference. You know, that there can be no forbidden knowledge, and that economics, politics, and jurisdictions don't impinge on that right to know.
Do you think we teeter on the brink?
Well, we've been teetering on the brink all along.
Since day one.
Yeah.
Well, I remember '93 when Mosaic came out, and I was like, no graphics. That's how you get ads. I don't want that thing.
Well, and then shortly thereafter, the NSF says you can have commercial traffic on the internet.
Well, and there have been dangerous accidents that took place all along that managed to get fixed. I mean, for example, if Larry Smarr hadn't been so determined to get Mosaic out of the door, you know, and pushed up Andreessen's project, to the point of, you know, public delivery. If Mark had another couple of months to work on it, the web would have been read-write from the jump. And as we had to suffer with
a read-only web.
Basically a broadcast medium for about 10 years.
Yeah, Tim Berners-Lee wanted a read-write
web. They, and actually, the World Wide Web, as implemented by Tim...
Was read-write.
I mean, it was, you know, read-write about theoretical physics.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, somebody showed me the heavy-lifting version of the web, and I think... it must have been 90. And, you know, first of all, I thought, oh, Jesus, this is hard.
Right.
And second, all the information on it is something that I'm not sure
part of
I'm...
physics.
I'm not ready to assimilate.
Yeah.
But, you know, you could see.
Right. When he created, just for those who don't know, I mean, the idea was it was as easy to modify. It was like a wiki. Mm-hmm. It was as easy to modify it as it was to read it.
And then it just wasn't because Mosaic.
Mark didn't have 4 months. I didn't realize that. So he wanted to implement that.
Yeah.
And he didn't get a chance to.
Right.
How interesting.
Netscape Composer
came around and implemented it later. And the problem of having it be, you know, broadcast has been eliminated.
Right.
Now, again, it's a conversation.
Traveler asks in our chat room, should we be more worried about corporate or government interference? Who's the bigger threat?
I didn't know there was a difference.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, what you should worry about are established centers of power.
Right.
And, you know, frankly, I think what you need to worry most about in most cases is the use of intellectual property law for social control, because this along with child pornography seems to be the instrument that is politically inarguable among mm-hmm. the masses.
And we keep seeing laws proposed one after the other.
Although that's an interesting comparison, because child pornography, that's totally inarguable. Once you bring that, it's almost like Godwin's law. You bring that up and it ends the conversation.
Not to put in a word for the child pornographers, but...
that's always the problem. You're going to sound that way no matter what.
I know.
You mustn't be a patriot.
Are you still abusing your child?
Yeah. Right.
No, but I mean, making child pornography in the first place is illegal up front.
There's plenty of laws.
Child abuse is like everybody knows there isn't a jurisdiction on this planet where that's
okay. It's not approved of.
And, you know, taking the next step and making information that's generated that way.
Right.
You know, there's a difference between the image and the action. And it's an important difference.
Mm-hmm.
And... So there's an arguability factor here. I think that the action is illegal enough.
There's sufficient protection.
When you talk about intellectual property, though, you have a lot of people expressing one thing and doing another. They may say, oh, yeah, I support those laws to protect copyright, but then they go and infringe it without even knowing it, without realizing it all the time.
And frankly, you know, I wish they would just get down to the economics, because... you know, as we discovered with the Grateful Dead, as we inadvertently invented viral marketing, being liberal with your so-called intellectual property is good for you economically. And you know, people originally would say, well, that worked for the Grateful Dead, but that's definitely a one-off. But I haven't seen anybody who tried it that it didn't work for.
Well, and it's interesting, when it becomes to the internet, even the folks who benefited from that same procedure in the old medium, like circulating the tapes, changed their mind. I was talking to Trace Beaulieu from Mystery Science Theater at Dragon Con, and I said, hey, you know, I'm one of the guys who used to circulate the tapes, because they would say that at the end of the show, keep circulating the tapes. Mm. And his reaction was like, well, don't do that anymore. Because
it's going on the internet.
Yeah, now because now it's the internet.
Well,
it's too easy.
I actually had a pretty heated argument with other people from the Grateful Dead at one point. I mean, Brewster Kahle, when the Internet Archive first got up and running, people were downloading or uploading Dead concerts.
Right.
I mean, immediately.
Of course.
You could count on that.
Seems natural.
And he called me up and he said, well, what do you think? And I said, well, Brewster, I think it's better to apologize than ask permission. And let's just see how long it takes my colleagues to find out. they did find out, and then they freaked out, and they wrote nasty grams, and then we had an internal debate, and finally came up with a policy where he couldn't. He would take down board tapes.
Right.
You know, the tapes that we had made ourselves that had escaped into the public.
But the tapers were okay.
The tapers were okay. And, you know, we're still selling albums of board tapes and doing quite well with them, you know.
Does Umphrey's McGee, I'm asking John, who's a big Umphrey's McGee fan, do they allow the board tapes to be distributed? Or they sell those at the end of every concert. You get a USB key or a CD with the board tape. So if people distributed them, they would say, no, that's not a good thing. Yeah, okay.
Well, I don't know that they would. Yeah. I mean, I know those guys. I mean,
they've got the similar model.
Well, they've got the similar everything.
Yes, even the music.
It's like, it's kind of more like acid metal, but...
Right.
You know,
well, it seems like
no lyrics. That's the problem. They need better
lyrics. Well, I know. I mean, they tried to get me to write songs for them at one point. I said, well, I don't see where you'd fit lyrics.
Exactly. I'm sorry. We're space jamming. Yeah. You come back later in an hour or two. Yeah.
But the point there is you sell it to the people who just had the experience. Those are the people going to buy it. A week later, your market has tailed off. Why not let it be circulated
or not? I mean, you know, the long tail works better with music than anything else I can think of. You know, there are certain dead concerts that took place in the 70s that are still you know, highly prized among
that
tapers.
That Upper New York State, 1974.
Yeah.
That was a great show.
No, it's like that.
It is like that. In fact, I had that
gig. I can't remember.
The Cornell gig.
Is like really legendary.
The legendary Cornell gig.
Right.
I have that one, actually.
Well, it's about adapting to the realities of the situation. You can't stop an infinitely copyable medium from being infinitely copied.
Well, that was my point. I mean, I wrote about this clear back in 93. You know, it looked to me like the only reason that copyright worked was because it was hard to make copies. Mm-hmm. You know, you had to manufacture a book. And that was challenging and industrial. But suddenly we were at the dawn of an era where even in 93 it was obvious that anything that a human being could do with his or her mind could be infinitely duplicated and infinitely distributed at zero cost. And, you know, people will do what they can and will. They really will. So, you know, this notion that the powers that have been have that, you know, the whole thing can be fixed with enforcement and education is, I mean, that's worked so well with the war on some drugs. I can't see why they think that it's going to work here.
They never learned that lesson. But. So what do we do, though?
Well, I think we go on. We go on behaving as we would if they didn't exist.
Oh, that's interesting.
To the extent possible.
I assume that this is going
to
happen.
I mean, and we try to come up with our own standards that are based on some combination of morality and practicality.
Right.
I mean, I think that it's fairly obvious to all of us when we're doing something that rips somebody off. Mm-hmm.
Tim O'Reilly argues that. He says, don't make a regulation, don't make a law.
Right.
For years, we have had taboos and mores that have governed our actions. You know, a lock on a door doesn't really stop anybody from breaking into your home. It's a signal that I don't want you in here, and taboos and mores protect you with that.
Well, in fact, a lock on the door can actually be an enticement.
Maybe not lock it at all.
For Kevin Mitnick, a lock was an enticement. Like, how do I get past that lock?
You know? But, you know, I'd have to issue a reluctant caveat. I mean, I was very much of the opinion that law as imposed by government wasn't going to work in a place where nobody had a jurisdiction and nobody had the capacity to find the perpetrator readily and to impose constraint. And for this reason, we were all going to have to go to the, you know, something like the Code of the West, which was...
I was going to say ranchers.
Coming from Wyoming, I mean...
Right.
I was,
there you go.
Yeah, I mean, that's why it's called the Electronic Frontier Foundation and not the Electronic Freedom Foundation. But, you know, I'd have to say that mores have not been universally successful in cyberspace. I mean, I thought that the spam problem would be self-regulatory.
Just because everybody would say, spam, bad.
Yeah, exactly.
Some people don't care what you think.
It's a low percentage response that keeps spam going, and that's the problem.
The marginal return necessary to make spam work is so infinitesimal.
Right.
that it's still worth it to these jerks.
And they're jerks enough not to care what mores, taboos, and society say.
And, you know, the same thing applies to malware one sort of another.
Mm-hmm. Very similar.
I thought that that would be self-regulatory to a greater extent than it has.
Well, you need laws. You could put a lock on the door that'll stop most people, but there's a few who will try to get through, and for them you need laws and law enforcement.
I don't think what you need is laws because I don't think they've worked.
Because they can't work. In a frontier, they can't work.
And I think that, you know, we have been insufficiently creative in coming up with technical fixes for both of those problems.
Actually, I think we're getting pretty good on both of those problems. We're working.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've got numerous...
You still have a big spam problem?
Numerous layers of filtration.
Yeah.
And I still, you know...
You just need more filtration.
Well, I mean...
It's like sewage treatment.
It's
you need a tertiary, tertiary treatment.
Filtering out an awful lot of stuff that I've
noticed. Right. I've noticed spam becoming less of a problem over the last couple of years.
It's,
and it hasn't gone away. It seems like the spammers are finding other means of making money in a lot of cases.
You don't hear people bitching about the air in Beijing either.
They're just used to it. Maybe it's like boiling the frog.
Right. Yeah.
So that's interesting.
By the way, that isn't true. The
frog will jump out.
He will jump out. I haven't tried this with...
It's a great metaphor,
I haven't tried this with a committee of frogs. I think it's possible that a committee...
We need a dozen frogs. John, can you get me a dozen frogs, a dozen boiling pots of water?
We need two dozen frogs.
Two dozen?
We need a dozen cold pots and then a dozen boiling pots.
See if they don't jump out. All right. We're going to do this experiment.
I think that, you know, that...
That's really funny. That's what I love about conventional
wisdom. Don't try this at home.
Conventional wisdom is so often bullshit, and nevertheless, people just buy it.
Sure. Yeah.
And it's just accepted as...
Well, and I'm probably one of the only people that would actually try that experiment.
Well, we need that. We need that kind of investigation.
And I didn't do it many, many times because that really...
You did it?
No, I did try it once.
And the frog jumped out?
Frog jumped out.
I love that.
How slow? Well, no, get down a rat hole.
But we digress.
So we had one of the things Bob Frankston suggested is that there is an opportunity for community internet run by, in some cases, local government, who provides the infrastructure, just as they might provide water and sewage, and then on top of the internet service provided by a number of companies.
You know, or even like a condo association. Or
I'm all for that, but I'm also a big fan of competition as being the way to create net neutrality.
I mean,
and the only way that I can see.
I am too.
Local governance of bit provision has led us into this unfortunate condition where, I mean, for me, in a relatively...
It's a duopoly.
Advanced places. I got my choice between Comcast and AT&T.
And that's it.
And AT&T is too slow, and Comcast is censorious.
Right. And you got nowhere to go.
Right.
It's a choke point. And so, choke points are what cause problems.
I remember seeing you talk about this, even in the board of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, this debate over how do we solve this net neutrality thing. Nobody wants government regulation, but on the other hand, these guys aren't going to regulate themselves.
Well, and you know, it's even a stickier issue because, you know, a certain amount of bandwidth shaping is in people's best interests in the wireless space. You know, I mean, if you've got an iPhone, even now, it's still very difficult to make a phone call in New York or San Francisco because, you know, your bit...
Is that because they haven't invested enough in the infrastructure or haven't been allowed to put enough towers up, maybe? Or?
There are a lot of different reasons, but I mean, they had a growth curve that suddenly hit them all of a sudden.
Right.
And, you know, it could have been fairly easily handled if they could have sorted out which bits could be buffered and which couldn't.
Or
there's nothing preventing them from doing that.
There is something preventing them from doing that. I mean, so far when they've tried to do that, they've gotten slapped down by the FCC.
Right, that's what Comcast got in trouble for.
Sure,
but the other solution is that competition solution. If every carrier had an iPhone, it wouldn't have been the issue.
Yeah, well, and also,
so artificial scarcity was created.
Also, I mean, I guess the government isn't doing much of anything useful these days. But you know, it does strike me that one of the things that government can do is to ward off monopoly. Or duopoly, or concentration of economic energy.
So you'd
energy.
Agree with the DOJ's shutdown of the AT&T T-Mobile?
That was I mean, that was so transparent.
It was a shock that they did it, though, don't you think?
I mean, it was kind of surprising that they had the guts to.
But what happens to T-Mobile? I mean, the question here is that can T-Mobile even survive without AT&T? I mean, you can definitely say that AT&T shouldn't be allowed to eliminate a competitor, but at the same time, T-Mobile may eliminate themselves.
Well, that's problematic. I mean, you know, the market is not necessarily smart.
Yeah. Well, the market isn't open for wireless right now. That's why I've got two hopes. I'd be curious to hear what you think of them. One is LightSquared. They want to use a spectrum that is right next to GPS to provide satellite-based LTE to the entire United States and open it up. They're going to be a wholesaler. Anybody can start a business on their platform. Problem is the GPS manufacturers are all up in arms because they've been bleeding over into LightSquared spectrum for years.
You have built-in latency problems that are...
Yep.
Satellite is very late. Yeah.
Right. But there's ground repeaters involved, so theoretically that might turn out okay.
Right. But this is where a government might have a role. Two roles. One is to prevent monopoly, but also to promote competition.
Sure.
Well, and promote that reasonable competition.
Thing. Yeah.
How do you feel about Google?
As I told those guys early on, I said, you know, anybody that says right up front, don't be evil, is courting evil.
You're asking for trouble.
You are just, I mean, like, we will be evil.
Right.
But I take an ironic view of things. I mean, power, it corrupts. It's a central axiom. It corrupts.
Right.
Power, it naturally adheres to any organization that has so much of the traffic of the internet flowing through it and is in a position to analyze that traffic in so many different ways. I mean, and even when they're trying to do good things, which they are, I mean, they often find themselves doing things that I find questionable.
Right.
You know, I mean, for example, there's the bubble that
the filter bubble, Eli Peres' filter bubble,
around ourselves, and it appears that they don't even know how to turn that off at this point,
right?
You know, because it is embedded in so many of the algorithms.
Mm-hmm.
There are millions and millions of algorithms that are involved in a single network search.
They might argue, though, that it's desirable. I mean, that improving one of the ways to improve search is to make it more relevant, more personal.
Well, of course, and that's a strong argument.
Yeah, isn't that what we want?
Well, everybody wants to be told what they want to hear.
But you know, Jeff Jarvis, it's great.
The stuff that actually matters to me is the stuff I don't.
You
like
don't
to
want to hear. That pains you.
You know, that's also how science works. I mean, science doesn't proceed by eureka. It proceeds by that's funny.
Well, the stuff you don't know you want to hear.
I think Jeff's point. Yeah, if you can move that a little closer, because when you talk to me, you go off my. Yeah.
Sure.
Jeff Jarvis's point is that, you know, it's a specious argument because we're, by the very nature of the internet, getting so much more information than we ever got before. People have always self-selected in terms of what they read and look at, and now you can't help it. There's information pouring over you from all directions.
Yeah, I want to have the right to know when I'm self-selecting.
Yeah,
and
don't use Google or log out of Google. And then it won't have any information about you.
You have that choice. But whether people will make that choice from a sociological point of view is a good question. A lot of people won't bother.
I feel strongly about it, and I don't bother. So there you have it.
All right. There's Google. How do you feel about...
But I'm not John Gilmore.
How do you feel about Bing?
In my particular case, you know, laziness overcomes ideology.
Right.
But, you know, in somebody like Gilmore's case...
He cares a lot.
Yeah. He'll walk before he'll...
Right. He cares.
Yeah.
How do you feel about Facebook?
Oh, yeah.
give me the good questions here.
Talk about choosing to be...
It is not the global village.
It's not.
It's the global suburbs.
Uh-huh.
And...
The gated global suburbs.
It's kind of like... It has this quality that's a little like, you know, high fructose corn syrup as opposed to broccoli. I mean, if the well was broccoli.
But on the other hand, if you were selling one or the other, wouldn't you want to sell high fructose corn syrup?
As long as there's a corn subsidy.
I had absolutely no sense of conscience.
Well.
I mean, I, you know, I,
Corporations don't have a conscience, do they? They're amoral. They're designed not to have a conscience.
That's right. And especially if they're corporations that have been created by people that are...
amoral to begin with, but...
Well, I mean, it's something about Asperger's that sort of works against your sense of conscience. But, you know, I think that Google, I mean, that Facebook has replaced real social networking for a lot of people.
Oh, that's interesting.
I have three daughters that are right in the target category, and all of them have kind of backed away from Facebook because they really have an instinct for wanting to be
actually social.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, and this is actually something I wrote about years ago. It's still, I think, pertinent. There's a fundamental difference between experience and information. An experience has so many characteristics, indefinable and huge characteristics, that are compressed into information,
right,
no matter how broadband that information is. I mean, it's like the difference between a cow and beef jerky.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of younger people are saying, wait a second, I'm spending all my time so-called socially networking with people I don't know and never really will. You know, better that I should focus on the people that I do know and hanging out with them and being in community with them.
Honda's tapping into that. I just saw an ad last night for Honda where the parents were going out biking or kayaking in their new Honda, and the kid was staying home saying, oh, Mom and Dad, they're so old-fashioned. They think that socializing is going out and bicycling. I'm online. I'm with my friends. I'm on Facebook. And so there may be... If Honda's doing ads based on that, there may actually be a nerve there that they're tapping.
Well, Windows
people
phone
know.
Ads were all about
same
get
thing.
Back to living your real life because you won't have to waste so much time.
So was the Well real? We should say John was one of the creators of the Well, which was an online service in the 90s.
First of all, had this quality of shared adversity by virtue of the savage user.
It was the Burning Man of online services.
trying to ride anything along was like, you know, kicking a whale across the beach with your bare feet. But also, I mean, it was...
Now, we're showing the Well, but I got to say, this is the modern day Well, which is very different.
It's Well Light. But
it stood for Whole Earth Electronic Link.
Yeah. It had a fairly small set of folks who also
cared
each other in meat space. I mean, there were lots of gatherings for well-being.
Right.
And there were many that were too far afield to come to a beach party in Stinson. But still there was enough actual social interaction so that it felt...
It strikes me online communities, this seems to be very common, where there's a tight initial core group that maybe doesn't physically know each other but has some affinity.
Yeah.
They kind of self-police, and then it goes wrong at some
point.
Well,
I mean, you know, what became of the Well is exactly what became of Bolinas.
Bolinas, for those who don't know, is a small Northern California town that for years would take the sign down on the road to Bolinas.
So you don't know where Bolinas is.
You can't get there.
We are Brigadoon.
It was a lot of hippies. It's a wonderful place. Yeah.
Well, sort of. I mean,
it's changed.
It's kind of like impacted community in a very, you know, like impacted molar.
Right.
But
it became very impacted.
And the Well also became nasty in that same kind of very...
It did.
Ugly small town way where, you know, people would
you get the flame wars in the Well. There were
lynch mobs.
Yeah.
You know, at the drop of an ASCII character.
Right. Right. Is that inevitable, do you think, in social community?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that
it's a hard thing to fight.
I think that communities, like any other natural system, tend to resemble the character of their origins. You know, and communities that are put together by people who are, you know, basically decent, nice people
will stay that way.
But, you know, there were a lot of people on the Well in the beginning that were, you know, were there because they were not socialized.
Right.
You know, and they looked at...
Maybe that's the problem. It's online
well
communities.
Kind of like training wheels
right.
for socialization.
online communities attract people who are more comfortable online, and right. as a result, they yeah. tend to have these problems.
And perhaps. Like attracts like.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's what always strikes me, is you get trolls in there, and it forces out the good because it gets less and less pleasant.
But, I mean, the environment is one where confrontation is non-confrontational.
Right.
You know,
it's safe.
I mean, the people will say things to one another or about one another right. online that they would never consider saying directly to somebody's face.
Right.
Because, you know, they're not, the likelihood of their getting slugged, you know, in real time, very shortly after making the remark is extremely low.
Minimal.
Yeah. Well, and there's just something different about knowing that there's going to be a reaction back, whether it's a slug in the face or just a comment. I mean, that's one of the mainstays now of people who do podcasting and blogs, is that if you actually react to someone, 9 times out of 10, they'll apologize for what they said. Not every time, but you know, more often than you might expect, because all of a sudden you became a real person to them.
Right.
Jaron Lanier, who was, I think, a well-being and certainly a big part of the community, just wrote a book called You Are Not a Gadget, in which he kind of turns his back on technology.
Well, I think that's a mischaracterization.
Okay, good. Tell me what... You know Jaron.
I know Jaron very well, and one of the great pleasures of my life is that Jaron and I make a regular practice of setting aside an afternoon to just sit down and talk about whatever comes to mind, and have done for years. And a lot of the things that percolated into his book were his half of that discussion.
Did you take opposite sides?
Well, I mean, I'm naturally a bit more optimistic
right.
than Jaron is, but not essentially. I mean, I think Jaron's book is very thoughtful about the limitations and downsides of virtualization
right.
of society. And we've gotten to this point, you know, especially because of the media. And I don't know whether I'm in the presence of the media or not here, but
we aren't sure ourselves.
Yeah,
we're reformed media.
Know, we have on the one hand or the other hand, and the opportunity to have a nuanced opinion that is, you know, alternately shaking both hands is
right.
really difficult.
Right.
So I mean, he's been characterized as being anti-technology when in fact he's doing something that I think is important, which is saying, "All right, look. This stuff has its limitations,
right?
And it, you know, and it has this capacity to cause natural human abilities to wither in some respect. I mean, it's like Alan Kay talks about auto prosthetics, where, you know, something starts out as an extension right. of a human ability, and because of the withering of that ability, thanks to the extension, it becomes a prosthetic.
Oh, that's mm-hmm. interesting. Yeah.
And I think you see an awful lot of that.
Yeah.
If I remember right, one of the points he makes is that we create a technology and then we limit ourselves by it. I think he used MIDI as an example
right.
of that, which
that's
is
exactly
MIDI
right.
was a great thing. He wasn't saying MIDI was bad. He's not anti-MIDI,
yeah.
but we sort of stopped there. And all of a sudden, all music was built in the MIDI format
right.
when we could
which
be doing so much more.
Pretty primitive.
It. Yeah.
And it was great for what it could do. I mean, the same thing is true now with sampling sound routinely at 44.1 kilohertz. You know, look, reality is analog, and that's going to always be the case.
Damn it.
Well, it's fine. But you can...
Nick Bostrom might disagree.
You know, we have the capacity now to do samples that are much higher res than
yeah.
that. You know, I mean, for example, you know, you take a 20,000 cycle sound, which is the harmonics of which are perceptible, if not audible, except, of course, your dog. And, you know, you're only going to have 2 sample points
right.
in that sound.
Right.
And you need
right.
more than that to actually have a, you know, a
good
real
point.
Shape. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, we get stuck on these things that become limiting standards for, you know, long periods of time. And, you know, we just need to be more fluid in our standard setting.
So he's not saying throw out technology.
Oh, no. I mean, hardly. Just, yeah. you know, remember that there is this other thing.
Do you, would you say that you are more focused on the benefits of technology, or?
I'm grumpier about this stuff than I was back during my, you know, the heyday of my techno-utopianism.
Right.
But I expected that to be the case.
Right.
I mean, I, You know, I feel like, you know, it's also true that one way to invent the future is to predict it.
Alan Kay. Oh, he said
what
to
he
invent
said,
it.
The best way to predict
the future,
predict
was
the
to
future
invent
is to invent it. And
right.
I think the inverse is also true. And I, you know, in my predictions,
I think was, you're right.
I was trying to create a set of expectations. In any case, I think you know, we've now had enough time to see how a lot of these things are going to work, and I will stand by some of the fundamentals of my earlier predictions. I mean, I think that, you know, for example, the ability of physical world governments to exert sovereignty over cyberspace is still questionable.
I agree.
The Chinese notwithstanding.
I agree.
And
well, they pay a price. Let's put it that way. I mean, they maybe are able.
Well,
to
and
do
I don't.
It,
you know, I don't even know how well it's working in China.
Right. Well, it's not.
It's full of holes. Yeah.
It's full of holes, and I think actually many of those holes are intended to be there. I mean, I.
Oh, that's interesting.
I was involved in getting China online to begin with.
Really?
Yeah. Mitch and Dave Farber and I flew over there to at the invitation of the Academy of Sciences in '94. To give a talk on the internet.
No kidding.
And there was this banquet afterwards, and I was seated next to the woman who was the vice chair of the Academy of Sciences and was in charge of the intra-Chinese computer networks, which put together the five main universities in China. And we'd had a number of fiery toasts, and I was starting to get pretty abstract. And I said, before we have another toast, her name was Madam Who. Like who's on?
Madam Who?
Before we have another toast, Madam Who, I want to talk to you about the internet. And she said, that's good. That's why you're here. And I said, no, I mean in addition to our speech this afternoon. She said, that's why you're here. And I said, okay, I want to see China on the internet. And she said, so do I. And I said, well, if you folks want to be on the internet, why aren't you? And she said, because your Department of Energy won't let us, because they're convinced that if we get on the internet, we'll steal all of your...
the way they might have been
all
right.
we'll steal all of your nuclear secrets.
They might have been
and
right.
And I said, well, I would assume that 20,000 grad students did a perfectly fine job of that. She said, of course they do. And besides, you don't have that many.
Nice.
And I said, well, maybe we can go back to the DOE and do something about
good.
This.
Which, and you did?
Which we did.
Great.
I said, but wait, you know, it strikes me that there are people in your government who would have difficulty with giving every student in China
you bet.
A global printing press. And she said, of course there are, but I'd rather apologize than ask permission.
That's great.
She knew, and this is a member of the Politburo. You know,
it strikes me the compromise they ended up making was the elites do know how to get around the blocking.
And the elites are getting larger.
That's right.
And if you have the right friends, you can,
right.
Yeah.
They're probably still
right.
concerned about barricades and marches in the street. But as long as the elites, you know, are circumspect and the masses are
Well, the Chinese have a natural and diminishing fear of the great cultural revolution.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
the return of that.
That's the huge scarring event in Chinese history,
absolutely.
Where you've got a sudden cyclonic accumulation of opinion and mass psychosis.
Yep.
And they were afraid that understandably that
they didn't want
one
that to
of these
again.
Could develop again.
Yeah.
So they built in a lot of buffers that I think.
I have a lot of respect. I think that they've moved judiciously. I mean, look, there's plenty of human rights violations, but it's a very big country and a very unwieldy beast.
And it's not anything like as monolithic as it appears to be from here. I mean, it's a very... it's a pluralistic society to a much larger extent than we conceive it.
Yeah, we don't think of it that way, do we?
No.
Yeah.
Right. We see single-party system and we stop.
Right.
Yeah.
That's...
You know, well, I mean, you know, anytime you got a single-party system, you have divisions in that party.
Sure. Well, we have a single-party...
Well
we have a single-party system
in
the United States for all intents and purposes.
American corporatism.
There's two wings.
Well, are you positive about anything? Are you bullish? What do you feel is... what's the good news?
Well, the good news is that things have now gotten so lousy that they can only...
No, I mean, this is why he's a great lyricist, ladies and gentlemen.
There's got to be a pony in here someplace.
I'm down so far, look like up to me.
Yeah. No, I mean, I stand directly with Heraclitus, who came up with the idea of enantiodroma 2,500 years ago. And that is, you know, the notion that everything is in the continual process of becoming its opposite at all times.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think things are pretty dreadful along a great many different dimensions.
We've hit one side of the pendulum.
But, I mean, any shadow this dark must have been cast by a very bright light someplace.
Sure. Do you think we're headed for a...
Press on.
One thing we haven't seen in a long time is a big jump ahead in the internet. Now, I'm not talking about the web or social networking or apps or even phones, but, you know, we're still working with HTTP and TCP and...
Well, all the protocols still work.
Do you think that we need another jump or...
I don't know that we do. I mean, it seems like... I mean, I think that we need to do something about DNS. I think that that's overly centralized.
DNS is broken.
I think it's too fragile. Even in a somewhat distributed state, I don't think it's a great idea to have there be one route to the whole damn thing. And I also, you know, I have problems with the political centralization of ICANN and the extent to which it creates these large areas of virtual unreal estate.
Like the .XXX.
For people. Well, and now they're going to be like, you know, a great multiplicity of these.
If you can pay for it, you can get it.
And suddenly ICANN's going to be sitting on top of, you know, $1 billion worth of registration fees.
What motivated that move? That was a very strange thing. Was it to get those $1 billion?
No, I don't think that. I think... You know, that was an outgrowth of their wanting to put up some kind of reasonably high tariff so that they weren't just completely flooded with trivial.
So they were afraid it would happen anyway, and they wanted.
Didn't want it to go through a .XXX every time. Maybe
we're talking about the fact that you can grow your own TLD top level domain.
Exactly. So instead of them having to adjudicate everyone, they make
but
a
I,
system.
You know, I just think I can't see much good that's going to come of it unless you happen to be a lawyer.
And there's a lot of things in this country that could be set up.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. Including patent law.
Yeah.
How do you feel about software patents?
I think it's ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, I think it's really important for law to reflect both common social practice and practicality. And the way in which patent in general is getting used is to restrict technology, not to grow it.
Kill innovation.
It's there for the enfranchised to squat on the innovators.
That's how all IP law has seemed. I mean, copyright law too.
Yeah, but that's precisely the opposite of its original purpose.
Right.
And so, I mean, I just think that IP law in general is increasingly a bad idea.
But if you say that, and if you suggest we should roll things back, then you get looked at like a child pornographer.
I mean, I just defended child pornographers, so...
Yeah. He didn't. It's going to be in your Wikipedia article, and I don't want to have anything to do with that.
No, but, I mean, seriously, like, the EU just extended their copyright when all rational evidence suggests we should be restricting
well,
it.
Well, fortunately...
And there's even been studies done that say it would be economically beneficial to restrict it to a limited period of time.
You know, I was on this bizarre panel... at the EG8.
I meant to ask you about that because there were a lot of people, including Cory Doctorow, who were EG8 dissenters that said Sarkozy has one agenda only to use your names to rubber stamp his anti-internet.
It was pretty clear what his agenda was, but I
to civilize the internet.
I mean, the irony of that, I mean, I'd written something called Civilizing Cyberspace in 1990, and I meant something very different.
Completely different. I thought it was great that you went. Jeff Jarvis went.
Yeah.
I wanted to go. I had to bail at the last minute. But
we became, you know, a real fly in their ointment.
Right.
You know, anything but rubber stamps. But, I mean, there was this panel of sublimely uncluful, you know, the head of Vivendi, the head of Bertelsmann.
Mm. Right.
You know, the head Publicis. Of the head of Fox. You know, 20th Century Fox. And they were all, you know, absolutely and blandly convinced that they would get this thing under control according to their standards, and you know,
you were on that panel,
and I was on that panel, and I, you know, I finally came down to me, and I said, you know, guys, we're not on the same planet.
I remember that.
And you know, you have a fundamental problem, which is that, you know, by various means, you've created a whole generation of electronic Hezbollah who hate you.
Yeah.
And they will be alive when you're dead.
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy.
And the things that you are trying to impose on them will not work. Because, you know, they get the last laugh. And I still feel that. You know, I mean, I think we're going to... practice is becoming what prevails in spite of...
Well, they can realize it now, or they can realize it later.
Right. Copyright Objective or ACTA, or you know, or the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. I mean, all these things are huge obstacles to the future, but they are not insurmountable.
Do you believe in civil disobedience in the face of those kinds of laws?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. Well, sure. It's interesting. Larry Lessig says, change the law, don't break the law. But I have to say, I don't have much confidence in his ability or our ability to change the law.
Yeah.
At least not before everything dies off.
You know, I don't believe in questioning authority. I believe in bypassing it. You know, I don't think of it so much as being as being a lawbreaker.
You just don't give them the authority.
A law ignorer.
Right. They don't have the authority.
It sounds like you believe in common law over statutory law.
I believe that common law has a way of developing.
Yeah.
In a much more ductile fashion, well, especially if you have laws as these are, that are there to impose the status quo on the future,
right?
And I think that's the real issue. It's about control, and it's about control of the future by the past.
The thing I really love about the EFF, Electronic Frontier Foundation, which you founded along with Mitch Kapor in, was it 90?
90.
90.
Yep.
Is that you, it's all about the law. It's all about going to court and fighting it.
It is not all about the law.
Okay.
I mean.
Then I'm going to take my money back. No.
No, I mean.
I'm proud to be a sustaining member.
We have a bunch of staff technologists, and that aspect of our operation is increasing.
That's true. Yeah.
You know, who go to technical standard setting meetings, mm-hmm. and also propose technical standards. I mean, we're in the process of writing a new system for certification of of key certifiers to eliminate the kind of problem we just
DigiNotar
had.
Yeah.
With DigiNotar, and there are a lot of ways to address those from a technical standpoint. I mean, we use the law when we can use it, but from the very beginning, we felt like the law was only going to be useful for a while.
Right.
It's actually been, you know, we've done reasonably well given the fact that we're up against, you know, the assembled mass of the entire industrial period.
You're really John Ludd, aren't you?
Kind of.
With your mallet.
We refute it thus.
EFF.org. I am very proud to be a sustaining member, and I encourage everybody to donate and...
Please do.
And read.
And read, you know. I mean,
read. There's lots to read.
What's really important is to find out what the hell's going on, because it's, you know, it's difficult and detailed, and the more we can crowdsource solutions to these problems, the better off we're going to be.
Couldn't agree more. John Perry Barlow, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, guys.
We appreciate it. And it was such a pleasure. I came in and you were here. I thought it was another Skype interview. It's so nice to meet you.
No, it's a lot easier to do this.
Yes, it is. And we welcome you to our new...
It's you know...
Anti-media media room.
The advantage of meat space, once again.
It is. There you go. It's nice. We do this show every Wednesday when we can find a victim. I mean, a smart person to talk to at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern at twit.tv. And, of course, after the fact, you can subscribe and get the shows. And there are a lot of shows now. And two with John Perry Barlow, and I encourage you. We didn't go in great depth into your history and background because we did that in the first
show.
Well,
you know, I don't live very far away. Anytime you want me to...
Love having you here.
Anytime you want me back, I can drive.
Maybe we'll get you and Jaron up and recreate one of those debates.
That would be.
I would like to do that.
They aren't really...
Not debates, discussions.
They don't debate, but I mean, you know, Jaron has this remarkably childlike ability to, you know, cut the crap and get down to the essence. Yeah. And, you know, he constantly says things that are, you know, like, blazingly obvious the second that he says them, but nobody ever said them before. Hmm.
He's brilliant.
Oh, he is.
Yeah. As are you, and I'm really glad we could get you here.
I make a good foil for it.
Hey, anytime we get to say Noam Chomsky, we're happy.
Noam Chomsky.
Doesn't come up a lot, I'll be honest. Thank you for joining us, and Tom, thank you. We'll see you next time on Triangulation.
Thank you.